Good. Okay, did people bring back the handouts from last time? Good, because we're going to talk about a couple of those, and there's a little bit more assigning. I have a couple of them, if you didn't bring it. You need it? Okay, so it's basically this. You got the poems that were assigned, right? So you're okay with that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's just... anyone else?
Which one are you
going to... We're going to look at A Slumber Did My Spirit Seal, the Wyatt poem, They Flee From Me, and the Pope passage from his Essay on Criticism. So it's on the same handout that I also gave you the poems to write about on. Okay, and here is another handout that we're probably not going to get to today, but you should bring this on Tuesday. We will eventually get there. So, you actually have a serious reading assignment for like a week from today. I know, it's shocking, right? But the serious reading assignment that you have is the first two books of Paradise Lost. So that's serious. It'll be good. It may take you a little while to get into the, shall we call it, the rhythm of it, the meter of it, the swing of it. We might look at one of the passages that's coming around right now, which is from book one of Paradise Lost. I said book two, but it's from book one. I don't know why I typed book two. Anyhow, it's from book one. I think it's because I is the first letter of the alphabet and the first word of the first thought of the mind. So I just typed I twice. What you should know about Paradise Lost... Oh, remember the no computer rule? Just... by way of a reminder, I would love to have everybody doing, what did I call it last time? Book face. So how about puzzle face, smiley book, whatever it is. But the university is strict about it. So I would be the one in trouble. Not actually true, but it's a good excuse. Okay, so just to tell you a little bit about Paradise Lost for those who don't know about it, it's the subject is man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden till one greater man, but he doesn't actually do it in Paradise Lost, restored us and regained the blissful seat. So that's what it's about. And it tells the story, the entire poem tells the story of the beginning of Genesis. That is, that there's a garden, it's called Eden. There are the first two human beings in the garden who are Adam and Eve. Some debate you may know about whether Eve was actually one of the first two human beings. There is a tradition, a Kabbalistic and Midrashic tradition that Adam actually had a consort before Eve. Do you know her name?
Mm-hmm.
Lilith. That Lilith, do you know why she got kicked out of paradise and was replaced by Eve? Anyone know? She was too feminist for God and for Adam. And in particular, the thing that they really didn't like was that she insisted that half the time they had sex, which they did before eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, that they do it female superior. And Adam just thought that wasn't right for women to be on top. And God agreed, so she got banished from Eden and... became the devil's consort. So Milton actually knew about this tradition, although it's not part of Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost is following the biblical story where Adam and Eve are the first two human beings. Lilith does not come into Paradise Lost. Adam and Eve are the first two human beings. And do you remember what they did that they shouldn't have done? Yeah, actually, it's not an apple. Although the reason it gets called an apple in modern English is because apple is actually a word that originally meant fruit. So in the older translations, the word fruit is translated as apple, like in pineapple. Pineapple doesn't look at all like an apple, but it just means it's a certain kind of fruit. So in Milton, it is an apple, though, or at least it's fine if you think of it as an apple. They eat the fruit of the forbidden tree. The Lord is not happy with them. How does he know they've eaten the fruit?
They clothe themselves?
Yeah, so that might be a weird question to ask about God. How does he know something? But in Genesis, the way he knows it, or seems to know it, is that Adam and Eve are hiding from him when they used to not hide from him. And when he finds them and asks why, they say, well, we were kind of embarrassed about being naked. And he said, who told you you were naked? Where'd you learn that? So this is all the beginning of Genesis. They then get kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And the curse that's put upon them is that Eve will, and that women in general, will have very painful childbirth. That is the punishment for sin. That men will have to work to get their food, that it won't just be everywhere in a kind of Edenic abundance. So that's the story that Milton expands over a book-length epic. We're only going to do the first two of 12 books of Paradise Lost. Possibly we'll look at a couple of other moments. But Paradise Lost is generally considered to be the greatest non-dramatic poetic work in English. By non-dramatic, I mean not Shakespeare. Yeah.
Where can we find these books?
So Paradise Lost, I think, but I'm not positive that the bookstore has it, but it's very easy to get online, and I'll send a link. You can also do the thing that you shouldn't do, which is to, you know what I'm going to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it's okay. You can read plot summaries of it, or you can read parallel modernizations. But because this course is about poetry, that's not, you should also read the original. And if you don't, then the paper you read in Paradise Lost is not going to be good. But just to either reassure you or unreassure you, Milton published Paradise Lost in his 60s, and it didn't sell very many copies. And his publisher said, I think one problem is no one can understand it. So it's not just that we in 2022 can't understand it, it's that Milton's readers in 1666 couldn't understand it either. And so the publisher said, look, we'll put out a second edition, but you have to write plot summaries for each book. So this is like the first grade saver in history, is that you have to write these plot summaries. So the every book of Paradise Lost in the second edition, which is the standard edition, has a plot summary just before the book starts, which is called an argument. An argument, as it's used in the 16th and 17th century, means a very quick plot summary in advance so you can follow what you're doing. Unfortunately, the plot summaries are not actually easier than Paradise Lost, but at least they're there. But what should either reassure you or unreassure you is that even then, people found it hard. But finding it hard is one kind of pleasure. Overcoming something difficult is one kind of pleasure. And the amazing thing about Paradise Lost is the character of Satan. So the way, you did it, right?
I read it in high school.
In high school, okay. So the character of Satan is, you may not remember him from Genesis, and that's because it doesn't seem like he appears in Genesis. Later, it will be claimed, and Milton will, in the New Testament, the claim is that the serpent is actually Satan in disguise. So the snake that gets Eve to eat the apple or the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil is actually Satan. So Milton is up for that. And so the way he tells the story is that Satan and this is conforms to a Christian interpretation of the New Testament, is that Satan and some other angels decided that they thought that God was a tyrant. And the people know what Satan's famous line is. It's in Dante as well, and it's in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, among other places. But Satan has a very famous line, which is what causes his fall. So it's the line doesn't appear in Paradise Lost, but it's a line that you should know. It is, "I shall not serve." That is, he refuses to be a servant of God, or to have God get to boss him around like he's, I don't know, God. And Satan refuses that. So his line is, "I shall not serve." It's usually or often quoted in Latin. It's "non serviam," "I shall not serve." And it's in the future tense. That is, I'm not going to do it anymore, with the implication that so far he has done it. So in Dante, he thinks those words or says those words or those words become his. I think Dante is following a tradition which says it's about 12 seconds after his creation. So it happens like almost right away. He's created, he's an angel. He is has all the intelligence and knowledge of an angel. It doesn't take him long to figure out the situation and to reject it. And he then gets sent, thrown into hell. In Paradise Lost, Satan is the head of a third of the angels in heaven. That is, he is the leader of a squadron or of a company of angels, and they come to a third of the angels in heaven. And then God does something new after he's been there for a long time. All the angels have been there for a long time. As far as they know, they've been there forever, as Satan puts it, as you'll see. "We know no time when we were not as now." So he doesn't remember his own creation. And then God, this is not the part we're going to be reading, but just to tell you, what we find out later, God says, "I have this day begot whom I declare my only son." So I now have a son, he says, not a son on earth, but a son in heaven. "I have this day begot whom I declare my only son." We would correct that to "him whom I declare my only son," but it's a little bit of compression. So "I have this day begot whom I declare my only son." And Satan says to his besties among the angels, "Wait a second, who is this son who's displacing us? Doesn't seem fair that God just decided that this son was going to, as God says, unto him all knees shall bow and shall declare him Lord." And Satan essentially says, "Not me." And so he and a third of the angels in heaven, that those under his command, start a civil war in heaven. And they fight against God and his angels, led by the Son, for 3 days. And after 3 days, they're defeated. And their defeat takes the form of them being thrown over the battlements of heaven, the crystal battlements of heaven, and they land in hell. And in hell, that's where the poem starts, with them having fallen into hell, and they refuse to submit or yield. And so, actually, I wasn't going to do this right now, but let's do this since I did hand it out. Just again, this is to give you a foretaste of Paradise Lost. So this is the passage from book one. It says book two, but it's book one. And here is Satan speaking. Anyone want to read it? Okay, you don't have to. You'll have to read other stuff, but I know, Milton.
I can do it.
Okay, great. Go for it. Is this the region?
Is this the region? This the soil, the clime. Said then the lost archangel, this the seat that we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom for that celestial light. Be it so, since he who is now sovereign can dispose and bid, what shall be right? Farthest from him is best. Whom reason held equal, forth half made supreme. Above his equals, farewell. Happy
so notice that's an enchantment. Force hath made supreme above his equals. Keep going.
Farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hail, horrors, hail, infernal world, and thou profoundest hell, receive thy new possessor. One who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, and a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I be still the same, and what I should be, all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater. Here at last we shall be free. The Almighty hath not built here for his envy, will not drive us hence. Here we may reign secure, and in my choice to reign is worth ambition, though in hell. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven.
Thank you. So, very famous passage. Do you see why? Why it would be? Essentially, the first time that this assertion was made, that freedom is better than luxury, is one way of putting it. Better to have freedom even in hell than to serve in heaven, than to have to be a servant, no matter under what state of pleasure or joy. So the great moment here, I mean, this whole passage is great. It's a passage that if you memorize it, you will be happy that you have done so all your life. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime, that is hell, said then the lost archangel. A great way to describe him, the lost archangel. This the seat that we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom for that celestial light? And then his answer is, be it so. So he is declaring that he prefers God's punishment to the alternative. God is punishing him for not acting in a certain way, and he prefers that punishment to acting in that way. The basic idea of punishment is you should think that you wish you hadn't done the thing that you've been punished for, that the situation is worse than it would have been if you hadn't done what you're being punished for. But Satan doesn't have that reaction because the mind is its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. So lots of people consider Satan to be the hero of Paradise Lost. This is something that the poet William Blake said. This is something that the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley said. This is something that Frankenstein's monster thought. He learns to read by reading Paradise Lost. It's like Duolingo, except the lingo is Paradise Lost. He's actually learning, somehow this is supposed to be happening in French. it is Paradise Lost, which informs who and what he is. And the idea that Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley's husband, the way he put it is that you have to weigh Satan's faults with his wrongs. That is, faults are things that are wrong, that things about him that are not good. And in particular, his ambition is not good. But wrongs are the way God has wronged him. And so Percy Shelley says, if you weigh his faults with his wrongs, you may excuse the former because the latter exceed all measure. What God has done to Satan is so much worse, is infinitely worse than anything Satan does, which is to be ambitious, to want more power than he has. But once he's in hell, then his ambition obviously is not going to be met because he's in hell. His ambition isn't going to be met, but he still refuses not to yield. Courage never to submit or yield is the line where he describes that. He's showing the courage never to submit or yield. So lots of people think that Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost, and that the poem is a poem about standing up to tyrannical authority. And there's something pretty amazing to write a poem about, writing a poem about standing up to tyrannical authority when the tyrant is God and the hero standing up to that authority is Satan. And that's a particularly amazing thing to be doing in England in the 1660s when the king, who is king of England, is anointed as ruling because of God's, because he's God's substitute or deputy. So it's a really revolutionary poem in many, many, many ways. That's part of what is thrilling about it, and especially thrilling about the first two books of Paradise Lost, which as I say, is what we'll be reading. Okay, one reason that I brought this passage in, and one reason that we've been talking a bit about the opening of Paradise Lost, besides getting you a little bit used to it, is because Milton's sense of meter is probably unexcelled by anyone else writing in English. Milton, as I mentioned before, thought that Paradise Lost was the first blank verse, non-dramatic poem in English. He was wrong about that. But it is always worth paying attention to what Milton is doing metrically, to the interplay of meter with meaning. So we've been talking a lot about the interplay of rhyme and meaning. The interplay of meter and meaning is a little bit more subtle than the interplay of rhyme and meaning, but it is the same sort of thing. So one of the things that we will be paying attention to is the way, when we talk about rhyme, we're interested in similarities in a context of difference. That is that, again, the death and breath rhyme. That's the similarity. The difference is the difference between life and death. So similarity in the context of difference and difference in the context of similarity. Another way of saying the same thing. And the basic idea, again, is that your mind, as you're reading poetry, is keeping track on various tracks of what you're reading or what you're hearing. And you're keeping track of sounds and keeping track of meanings. That's the simplest way of putting it. But you're also, and this is where and why meter is so interesting, and we've talked about this a little bit already, you are also keeping track of the difference between the syllables or words that the meter is stressing and the syllable or words that the meaning is stressing. So I'm going to repeat that because this is a subtle and hard point, but it's why poetry is not sing-songy. Otherwise, it would be. The reason people hate learning about meter is because they think it reduces poems to a kind of sing-song beat. And any good poem is not going to work that way. Any good poem is going to lay down a substrate of meter. In English, the plurality is going to be iambic pentameter for reasons that we will get into further. We've already talked about some of the reasons, which is that lots of English sentences are iambic pentameter just naturally. But in English, the substrate is going to be iambic pentameter, but there is going to be a kind of counterpoint, which is the words whose meaning would get stressed, even though the meter might not stress those words. So I just want to give you a standard example from linguistics, which is the way there can be... So essentially what I'm saying here is meter is stress. That's a standard definition of meter. If you say that standard is... What is it? Trochee or iamb?
Trochee.
Yeah. Okay. So that means that the first syllable is stressed. So meter is stress, but frequently we get to the point where the meaning will be stressing one syllable and the meter will be stressing a different syllable. And when that happens, there's a kind of counterpoint between the stress that meaning is putting on a syllable and the stress that the meter is making you expect that syllable to have. And this is where meter gets subtle, but where it gets powerful and effective. And that interplay between two different kinds of stress, you could say. One is phonological, that is the stress of sound. And the other is semantic, or the stress of meaning. When they don't correspond, and they frequently don't correspond, when they don't correspond, something rich and strange and dense happens. And poets who write really well in meter arrange for... Intuitively, they're not thinking this out the way we're now describing it, but they intuitively have a sense of a kind of dance between the stress of meanings and the stress of sounds. And when those things don't correspond, what we will often do is de-stress a sound that we also know is stressed. Or we will stress a sound that we will also know is not stressed. And I'll give you an example of that when we look again at the very opening of Paradise Lost. We've talked about this a little bit in Paradise Lost, but I haven't been explicit about what's going on. But when we look at the opening of Paradise Lost, you will be able to see this. But just notice... Well, okay, so a way to put this then is, and it's a way I already put it, I just want to remind you of it, is that in an iambic pentameter line, which we're just using that as an example, in an iambic pentameter line, what you have are 10 syllables, generally. You have 10 syllables, sometimes fewer, because you can have the equivalent of a musical rest in a line. Sometimes more, because you can have a kind of breath at the end of the line, but sometimes that breath can turn into a whisper. And so you can have an unstressed syllable or even two unstressed syllables at the end of a line without people thinking, wait, what's gone on metrically? But generally, it's going to be 10 syllables. And you can order those 10 syllables from least stressed to most. If you look at, this may be a hard one, but if you look at, is this the region, this the soil, the clime? Okay, if you try to do it from least stressed to most, what is the least stressed syllable in that line? What is it?
The.
Which the, though? Yeah, it is the, but there are three the's. Okay, so is this the region, this the soil, the clime? Good. Okay, does everyone agree with that? All right, after that, what would be the next the?
The second one?
So,
I think it would be region.
So how many people think it's the region, and how many people think it's the soil? The in those two phrases. Anyone want to make the case for the soil? Okay, I think it's the region as well. And then the soil. So the clime, that's the least stressed. The region is number 2 of 10. The soil is number 3. Okay, what's the next? What's the fourth most stressed syllable? I don't think so.
I think it's.
What do you think it is?
Oh, I was going to say this. We just said it wasn't this.
Yeah. So remember, iambic pentameter is going to go da 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 da. So to make this parodic, is this the region, this the soil, the clime?
Is.
Okay, maybe is. Mm-hmm. Is this. The region, this, the soil, the clime. If it's not is, the other possibility is? So there are five, the dividing line between syllables is there are 5 unstressed and 5 stressed. So we have 3 does as the unstressed. We've now added is as the 4th unstressed. What's the 5th one?
Half of region.
What is it?
Like the left part of region.
Yeah, which part?
Region.
Yeah. Yeah, because region is an iamb or a trochee?
Trochee.
Trochee, yeah. So it's either is or jun. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime? It probably doesn't matter that much, but you can hear that those are the unstressed syllables. Is, the, jun, the. Those are the unstressed syllables. And the stressed syllables are there for what?
This. Read, this, soil, climb.
Right. Okay, so now if you look at the stressed syllables, let's go from the other direction. Which is the most stressed of those? Okay, so say it the way you to stress it.
This the soil.
Okay, so is this the region, this the soil?
This.
Okay. Do people agree with that? That it's the second this? Anyone want to make a case for another syllable? Yeah.
I don't have a case, but I'm a bit confused. It sounds the same to me.
They all sound the same level? Okay, so do you ever act? Are you ever, like, on stage?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say you were acting Satan and this was your line. How would you make that line as dramatic as possible?
The whole thing?
No, just the first question, up to heaven. So make it, you know, really be dramatic.
Oh my God.
No, it's good.
Start from that we, that line?
No, no, start with is this and then get to heaven.
Like Satan? I can't do that.
You can't do Satan? So you never act the part of a villain?
No, usually the good character.
Oh, no. Well, what if he's a good character then? All right, thank you.
This the region, this soil, the clime. Said then the lost archangel, this is the
sea. Yep, this the sea.
The sea. That we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom.
Okay, that's great. All right, so you weren't actually stressing them all the same.
Mm-hmm.
I think the least stress was re in region, the way you said it. So... is this the region, this the soil?
The,
yeah.
I like the change like this. I think it's the first this.
Okay, so is this the region, this the soil? You really want the first this to be more than the second?
I'm confused now.
Good, you should be.
I'm hearing it differently because I'm like, there's different ways to like stress this. And like initially, like when we said it, I thought it was the second one.
Uh-huh.
When like, they performed it,
Okay, so can you perform it that way? Make it clear? Convince us. Through performance. No, it's okay. It's not hard. I mean, you were saying the words, so just...
Okay. Like, is this the region? This is soil, the climb.
Hmm. Okay, so do people find that performance convincing? Is this the region? This? No, 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 it's fine.
No, it's not...
Did anyone see Samuel Jackson on Letterman the other night? Are you too young to know who Samuel L. Jackson is?
No.
Good. What?
What guy?
Samuel L. Jackson.
He was in all the Tarantino.
Yeah, he really amazing in Pulp Fiction. Amazing actor. All right. Anyhow, he was describing a play that he's now in where he's playing the part of an older man, but it was a play that he started, that he played a different part in when he was very young. And he said that the director, one thing that was forbidden for him was to give notes to the young guy who was playing the part that he used to play. And he said, this guy is playing it totally different from the way he played it. And he said better, but, you know, he was being nice. I mean, it may be true, but he was also being nice. But that's the point, is that when you're an actor, you have to choose among possibilities. And so what you might do, if you're one kind of actor, is do it that way. Is this the region, this the soil, the climb? So the way I just did it there, yeah, Elijah.
Too confident.
Okay. All right.
That's how you would articulate it. If it was like a rhetorical question, you'd be the answer to. But if there's like any sense of confusion, the emphasis being on the first this would be too front-loaded.
Nice.
I think it should sound more distraught in the beginning than angry. And that's why I think the second this should be the one being emphasized. Because it's the first one. He sounds more angry to me.
I kind of like interpret more that like, he's kind of like sarcastic in a way. Like he's kind of like looking like this is like we're supposed to live now. Like, I guess it's more mocking in a way.
I mean, I guess it could be right. I don't know. This is how I see it.
Well, I feel like he's, like, thinking more along the way, though. Like, he would emphasize second this because he is, like, progressively getting more confused and mad at it. Like, he, like, does not have that conviction that Elijah said you have with that first this.
Okay.
Because Elijah was in the poem before, like, his confidence rose, and he was, like,
we are going to become like,
yeah, like he's building. He wouldn't start off like
exactly.
Judy.
What?
Yeah.
I was saying like it could be just anger starting this burning off where like I felt that.
So one thing maybe that we are all confident of is that it's not re. That it's not, is this the region? Is the soil, the climate? Like, okay, so we're totally confident about that, right? No one wants to do it that way. That would be the way you would parody a bad actor. That's the way you would do it on Barry, for example, if you had a bad actor on Barry. You all watch Barry? No, you're too young. So I actually lived in the house that Henry Winkler had lived in when he was young. The real Henry Winkler. No, not the character on the show. The real Henry Winkler. The one nice thing about this house, the only nice thing about this house, was that Henry Winkler once lived on it.
You still live in the house?
What?
Is it like your house now?
No. This was when I was an undergraduate.
Oh.
He lived in a house on Linwood Place, and later on, much later on, I lived in the same house. And people said, oh, cool, Henry Winkler lived there. So, now you know. Oh, shit. All right. I'm definitely pwned. Do you know what pwned means, or are you too young for that? Pwned, P-W-N-D? Yeah, this is older internet slang. You know what it is, right? Yeah, okay. People, explain it to these good people.
It means like you got owned.
Yeah, so why is it called pwned? Do you know? That's because you're on your phones all the time. Because it was a typo for owned. Because people typing fast would say, psych, you've been owned. But they would type the P instead of the O. That's where it came from. So you actually learned something in this course. Good. All right. So you definitely wouldn't go, is this the region? This the soil, the climb? That would be like the one impossible reading. But depending on how good an actor you are, I bet Alanish is good enough for this, you might say, is this the region, this the soil, the climb, and you do the first this. Or you might say, is this the region, this the soil, the climb, and then it would be the second this. And the meanings would be slightly different. There's a story about T.S. Eliot he was on a boat crossing the English Channel, crossing away from England towards France. And there was a young guy on the boat who said, holy cats, T.S. Eliot. You know why he said holy cats, right? Instead of like holy shit, why do you say holy cats? Because of Cats, the musical, which is based on T.S. Eliot. Did you know that?
No.
You didn't know that?
No.
Did you see the movie?
No.
It's a terrible movie.
I've heard.
Yeah, so have I. I haven't seen it either, but I'm confident that it's a terrible movie. Yeah, it's a book of Eliot's called Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. So at any rate, this guy sees Eliot, and he's a young poet, and it's T.S. Eliot. So naturally, he has to say something profound to Eliot. As one has to in situations like that. And so they are crossing the English Channel away towards France, and they see the white cliffs of Dover. And the guy says to Eliot, they hardly look real from here, which is the profoundest thing he could come up with on the spur of the moment. And so this is only known as a written account of what Eliot said. So no one knows how he said it. It's just a written account of what he said. He said the four words, oh, there, real, and enough. So, actors. Actually, let me just tell you this. Do people know what the Moscow Art Theater was? Do people know who Isadora Duncan was? Not a familiar name? You will. She's a legendary figure in the history of ballet, and she died in a very vivid way, which is that her scarf got caught in the wheel of the Bugatti convertible that she was being whisked away in. She was wearing the scarf. It was blowing in the wind. It got caught in the wheel, and that was it. And there, yeah, it's terrible. And there's a movie of it starring Vanessa Redgrave. At any rate, her husband and Stanislavski were the founders of the Moscow Art Theater in like 1904. And the way you auditioned for the Moscow Art Theater was you had to say the words good evening in Russian, which are a few syllables more than just good evening. But you had to say the words good evening. That was the only line you had to use to audition, was good evening. Something like Dobro Vechere, but that's not quite right. But what you had to do is you had to say that line 50 times. And you had to convey a different emotional background each time you said it. So you had to say it in 50 different ways and convey 50 different feelings, backgrounds, backstories, sense, context, like, good evening, right. You know, I'm sure we could all do two or three. Sarcastic mode of good evening, the tragic mode, the brave mode, maybe bravely tragic. Good evening. the happy mode, good evening. It really was. It was a good evening. So the point is that you can do that with lots of lines of poetry. And you can do it with, you could do something like, is this the region? This the soil? The climb? And then the thises wouldn't be quite in parallel, right? So is this the region? You're really looking at where you are right now. And region is just the word that tells you you're focusing on a place. But then you say, this the soil? It turns out that region is also full of mud, full of dirt. The climb? And that would be different from, is this the region, this the soil, the climb? So the point is, there definitely there are different ways of doing it. And how you choose to perform it is going to emphasize different things the way T.S. Eliot's four words would be emphasized in different ways. So those of you, someone do it emphasizing, remember what the four words are? The white cliffs of Dover, they hardly look real from here. Okay, so someone do it in a dismissive way. Like this kid comes up to Eliot, the kid says, they hardly look real. Eliot says, oh God, another person who thinks he's so cool. And so Eliot says, what?
Oh, they're real enough.
Yeah, oh, they're real enough. You know, meh. It's sort of like the emphasis would be on the meh part of it. You just said something meh. Okay, what about, what happens? Someone do a second version emphasizing a different word. Just any word but oh. Not oh, they're real enough, but I'm not saying a syllable, a word. Just emphasize a different one of those four words.
Oh, they're real
enough. Ooh. As opposed to what?
Oh, right? Real? They're enough? That's wrong?
That's wrong.
Yeah.
Because you're doing it in the wrong order. The order is oh, they're real enough.
Oh, but, they're real enough.
Oh, nice. Do you hear the difference?
Yeah.
As opposed to whom? Or us. We are just ghosts that flitter through the world and then are gone and no one knows our place. But those cliffs, they're real enough. So we had, oh, they're real enough. Or, oh, they're real enough. What if you do enough? Someone stress enough. Yeah. Oh, they're real enough. Like, how much reality can you possibly want out of the world? Oh, they're real enough. You don't need more than that. So depending on which one you stress, they're four different meanings. Four different performances give you four different meanings. And that is going to be true over and over again in poetry. To give you an example, from poetry meant to be spoken, this is Hamlet. Some of you may know that in Hamlet, Hamlet says he's ranting at Ophelia because he's being a jerk, as he is frequently in the play. He's ranting at Ophelia, and he says he's done with love and done with women and done with all that stuff. And he says, "Go to, I'll no more on it." That is, I'm not going to deal with any more of this. "Go to, I'll no more on it. It hath made me mad." Because he might be mad. That's one of the questions about the play Hamlet. Is Hamlet mad or not? Or is he just pretending? Is he faking it? So he says to Ophelia, "Go to, I'll no more on it. It hath made me mad." That is the standard performance of that line. I mean, the standard performance is much better, but that's the standard performance of the line. But Derek Jacobi did it in a different way, which brought out something totally different in that line, which is he says, "Go to, I'll no more on it," and suddenly he's drawn up short because of the way he's been treating Ophelia, whom he loved and whom he had given gifts to and said he loved, and now he's ranting at her. And he says, "Go to, I'll no more on it." And then he stops and pauses. And then he says, "It hath made me mad." Like, whoa, it's true. Not "it hath made me mad," but "it hath made me mad." So Shakespeare is allowing, when he writes the play, he's allowing his actor to choose which words to stress. But an actor always has to pick one or another. When you're reading Paradise Lost, you don't. And the reason you don't is because you're reading it rather than performing it for someone else. And the result is that it's wrong. In most cases, it's going to be wrong to say that one word is correctly, it's correct to stress this word and not correct to stress this other word. It's like rhyming two words that are antonyms or that are simply different parts of speech, which is that your mind is understanding a series of overlaid possibilities, a series of juxtapositions, kind of like, you knew this was coming, Schrodinger's cat, where a word is both stressed and unstressed at the same time. If you perform it, you have to decide which word to stress. But if you don't perform it, you can get one kind of stress which your mind is registering with auditory cortex. That is the part of your brain that is just paying attention to the rhythm and sound of the rhythm. And another part of your mind is stressing a different word for its meaning. And those two things are superimposed on each other. And in a powerful poem, that superposition of different stresses, depending on whether they have to do with meaning or with meter or with rhyme, because rhyme is a kind of stress as well. When you hit a rhymed word, the very fact that it rhymes gives it a bit of stress, gives it a bit more stress from the fact that it rhymes. So that very fact, it's like there are three stresses that are superimposed on each other. When the word is the last word of a line of poetry, like the word climb here, that tends towards a kind of stress because your brain is saying, gotta hop back to the beginning of the next line. There's a little bit of pressure that occurs in your mind as you're reading the word climb and then darting your eyes back. And there's just the ghost of a pause, even if you do, you don't stop for the enjambment. So you say, this mournful gloom for that celestial light, be it so, since he who now is sovereign. So notice that line, for that celestial light, be it so. So be is probably the most stressed word, right? For that celestial light, be it so, since he who now is sovereign? No, it's going to be rather, be it so, since he, end of line, don't pause, quick, get to the next line. But all of that is a kind of ghost of a pause. Be it so, since he who now is sovereign. Now, if you're an actor, you would say, be it so, since he who now is sovereign. But if you're reading it, even if you have to know that you're not supposed to pause, knowing that you're not supposed to pause, that moment of knowing that you're not supposed to pause is a kind of stress. So again, in high school, you're taught if something is enjambed, don't pause at the end of the line. Just don't do it. But the very fact that you're told that, which is right, itself constitutes a kind of pause. Not a literal pause, because you just keep reading, but a kind of pause, which is simply your knowledge not to pause there. It becomes an issue at the end of a line, do I pause or not? And you can be really, really good at it, never make a mistake, and always enjam to the next line. But it is always somewhere in your mind that that's what you have to do. And that itself gives you an experience of a kind of stress, which is different from the kind of stress that you get if you have a word like, this, is this the region, which is stressed for a different reason, or a stress like region, which is just stressed because it's a standard troche. So is this the region? No one is going to go, is this the region? But is this the region? This the soil, the clime. Elliot, you didn't get this, so let me give it to you. I have to tell you, you have to close your computer. So that is something to notice and that we'll be paying some attention to. Look at the passage above it. This is from one of Yeats's last poems, perhaps his last poem, in which he is thinking about all the poetry he's written earlier in his life. And if you know Yeats, you may recognize what he's talking about here. If you don't, that's totally fine. But he says to himself, this is one stanza. All of the whole poem is written in what, does anyone know what this meter is? We saw it already in Byron. It's fine if you don't, but if you do, that would be cool. Remember Hail Muse, etc.? That's in the same form. It's called ottava rima. So we talked about terza rima, remember? It's A, B, A, B, C, B, C, D, C, etc. So you stop with the Center for Disease Control. All right, so ottava rima is 8 lines, and it's A, B, A, B, A, B, C, C. So you get this alternation, A, B, A, B, A, B, 3A rhymes, 3B rhymes, and then a couplet to end the stanza, C, C. Okay, so he's asking himself, what can I do but enumerate old themes? First, that sea rider ocean led by the nose through 3 enchanted islands, allegorical dreams, vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose. Themes of the embittered heart, or so it seems, that might adorn old songs or courtly shows. But what cared I that set him on to ride? I starved for the bosom of his fairy bride. So that's Yeats thinking about why he wrote that poem and how it was the fantasy that mattered and not the meaning of the fantasy. So you don't need to know this, although you should find it cool that what he's basically saying is, yeah, I wrote this poem and it looked like it was an allegory, you know, like Game of Thrones was really about contemporary political issues. But the reason I wrote it was not that I cared about saying anything about contemporary political issues. It's that I just thought this fantasy world was so cool. So that's what he's saying here about his own fantasy poem. And look at the fourth line. So ocean is led by the nose through three enchanted islands. And on those islands, he has an experience of gaiety, of battle, and of repose. Okay, so can someone read that line aloud? Any way you want to, just vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose.
Vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose.
Okay, good. Let's do it again, someone else. Go for it. Just that one
vain
line.
Vain deity, vain battle, vain repose.
Okay. All right. Now, Yeats's iambic pentameter is looser than a lot of iambic pentameter, but it's still iambic pentameter. Yeah.
That be considered a tricolon crescendo.
A what?
Tricolon crescendo.
Yeah. Okay. Explain yourself. Yes.
So is that when you repeat? Increasing in emphasis, so the last thing should be more than the second one.
Okay, so read it.
So I think that would be like vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose.
Okay, so it's definitely crescendo. Everyone knows that crescendo is increasing emphasis. It's when things get louder and louder in music. It is from the word, anyone, do you know its root?
No.
It's same as crescent moon. Or croissant, for that matter. It means, what does crescere mean in Latin, anyone know? It means to grow. So a crescent moon is a moon that is, it's usually a waxing moon is the idea. A croissant looks like a crescent moon. Did you know that's where the word croissant came from? It looks like a crescent moon. So it's also the reason the crescent moon is an Islamic symbol, because it's increasing. The word increase, the crease and increase is also growing. So crescendo means it's growing in volume. Okay, so now do the meter. It's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's a little bit hard, and yet it's still kind of there. So if you do it parodically, you would have vain gay, right? And then the second foot, vain gay. So vain gay, it T, right? That's really pushing it, but it's still there. It's not pushing it beyond beyond the White Cliffs of Dover. It's real enough. So vain gay, it T, vain battle, vain repose. So which vein is the most stressed? Yeah. The first two are unstressed. Same word appears three times in that line. The first two times it appears, it's an unstressed word. Vain gaiety. Vain battle. Vain repose. So not only is vain the most stressed of the veins, but it's probably the most stressed, the third vein is the most stressed word in the line. So that is really cool that he uses this word three times, twice as an unstressed word, and the third time not only is a stressed word, but is the most stressed word. Vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose. And that's what gives you the crescendo. the tricolon crescendo. Yeah, that's what gives it to you, is that you didn't know that vain was going to be the word that was most important in this line, because first it appears simply to be a modifier for gaiety and battle, but then no, dude, it's vain repose. That's what's really going on. So again, just do people hear that? Can you hear how that's happening? That you have the beat, da-da, 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 da-da. You have words that are stressed, not either or, not binary, but 10 different levels of stress in any line of poetry. Obviously, the iti in gaiety, the t in gaiety is going to be the least stressed of the stressed syllables. And not only that, but it's less stressed than the first vein, you could even say. Vein gaiety. So vein gay, you also get what's not quite a rhyme. Do you know what that's called? Vein gay? What that combination of sounds would be called? So it would be a rhyme in a folk song. It would be a rhyme probably in hip-hop. It's a rhyme in a lot of oral work, but it's not technically a perfect rhyme. Why not? Slant rhyme? Okay, good. What prevents it from being an actual rhyme? If you had bought Bitcoin 10 years ago, like some of me, and lost your access to it because you just... Sorry. I didn't pay much for it, but it sure would be worth a lot now. Then what I would have realized would be a vain...
Pain?
A vain pain, good.
Oh.
I was going to say a vain gain.
Oh, I said gain.
Oh, you did say gain. That's all right, fine. Good.
Why did you lose access?
Because I switch computers. You know how that goes. I just paid no attention to it, and then it was in some file somewhere, and that was that. Okay, this is not shouldn't be the most interesting thing in this class today. So a vain gain, that would rhyme, right? But vain gay, not so much. So that's called slant rhyme, or it's called assonance. Assonance is when you get the same vowel sounds repeated, like in vowel sound. That would be assonance. So assonance is the complement to alliteration. Alliteration is when you get the same consonants over and over again. Complementary consonants can cause confusion. That would be alliteration. Assonance is when you do it with vowels. So partly you're feeling that vain gay, yeah, those are hooking up together not only as da-da, an iambic foot, vain gay, but also they're kind of equivalent to each other, vain gay. And then you get iti, and those are much less stressed, both of those. So the vain and vain gay is much more stressed than the T in iti, and yet the T is a stressed syllable, and the vain is an unstressed syllable. So what Yeats is doing, again, he's not thinking, how do I do this? He's hearing it. He's hearing how you can get from an unstressed vain, which is nevertheless a word that part of our minds is stressing, because it's like gay, and because it's an important word, all that gaiety was in vain. Vain gaiety, vain battle, and then vain repose. And suddenly the vain breaks out into the most stressed word in the line. And so what's happening in your mind, vain, that's an important word, also happens in the meter when you get to the third vein. So that way that things come together on different levels, different superpositions of stress, which can be caused by where in the foot a word is, how important the word is, and where in the line a word is, whether the word rhymes or not, and whether there's a punctuation mark after the word, which will also cause stress. All of those things, there are like four or five different ways or four or five different regions in the mind that will check the stress box, but for different reasons. And what will happen is sometimes you'll just get a whole bunch of different things that are stressed. So the meaning part of your mind will say this word is stressed, but the sound part of your mind will say no, it's not stressed. Won't say no, it's not stressed, just won't stress it. And then sometimes they will all build up so that they all get stressed at once. And when that happens, and it happens every line, when it happens, we treat that as the most stressed word in the line. When all the stresses line up, or when most of the stresses line up, we treat that as the most stressed word in the line. So what's happening is poetry is making us juggle stresses in our minds. And that juggling makes it possible for there to be this sense of buildup, of undercutting, of pointing to certain moments. Let's look again. I did want us to look at, we'll look at Pope starting on Tuesday at any rate. But let me remind you again of the opening line of Paradise Lost. So I'm going to write it down. Anyone remember it? After all this time? I know it's been a week. Okay. If you remember, tell me. Anyone?
First.
Good. Someone told me wrongly that this is the only four-syllable word in the middle of a line of English poetry. But it's not true.
It's a very rare fact to even give.
Yeah, that's why this person was proud of giving the fact. Okay, so we'll just, this is the line. Okay? So, if you were reading it in prose, if this were a prose line, let's do it as prose. And, sorry. So, if you're reading it in prose, what word would you stress? Or just start, someone read it in prose.
Of man's first disobedience and the fruits of, is it what?
Of that forbidden tree.
Of that forbidden tree.
Sorry, yeah. Okay, good. And so, you stress the word first. Right? Does everyone agree with that in prose? Of man's first disobedience. Because, of course, first is a stress word. Dis is a prefix. And usually you wouldn't really stress it. So man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. Something like that. Right? But if it's iambic pentameter, so that, you know, you use a slash to indicate line endings in poetry if you're quoting them without setting them off, you should always put a slash to indicate the line endings and a capital letter if it's a poem that capitalizes the next line. So if you're talking about Cummings, you would say B-L-A-C like that and then indicate the line ending. I forget, what is it? AG, is that whatever it is? And then line ending, etc. So, if you do that, you have of man's first dis, do you hear it? Of man's first disobedience and the fruit. So it's of man's first disobedience and the fruit. And if you do it that way, do people hear it? If you do it that way, you are stressing dis more than you're stressing first. So it's of man's first disobedience and the fruit. And doing it that way, two things are happening. Meaningfully, we know that humans are disobedient. We've been told that we're disobedient from as long back as we can remember. People tell you no electronic devices in class, but you still look at your phone under the desk. You're being disobedient. That's fine. You're disobeying Brandeis's rules. So, that's not the important thing. It's that it's the first disobedience. So, if you were reading this as prose, it would be of man's first disobedience. But the meter is telling you, no, it's of man's first disobedience. Do you hear the difference? And they're both right. That is, as far as meaning goes, the word first is the important word. Of man's first disobedience. But as far as meter goes, it's also of man's first disobedience. And the stress on that is as though the poem is saying, kind of shocking that there would be this disobedience. It's a somewhat unexpected stress, but it's really making you focus on a word that you might not otherwise focus on. The very fact that it's an iambic pentameter line means that the word dis, that the syllable dis, tells you focus on, ready for it, dis word. A man's first disobedience. So it's like, can you believe that this was the negative of obedience, of man's first disobedience? That's what we're talking about. So not of man's first disobedience, which is what we're also talking about. We're talking about both at the same time. And that's what meter can do, is give you both simultaneously. That it's meaningfully, it's the first, but the real shocker is that we should ever have been disobedient. So those two things are happening simultaneously. And that's what meter and meaning and different kinds of stress superimposed, but sometimes coming apart, sometimes coming back together, that's what they do. Okay, see you Tuesday. Remember, you have till midnight to get your papers in. Otherwise, they'll be late. And send them to me in a doc format of some sort. Google Docs or Word or simple text, whatever. Okay, have a good weekend. See you Tuesday. Bye. Bye, Lily.